Welcome back. This is Andy, and this is chapter two of the Gastropocene. Always with my co-host. Say hi.
What's up?
So today we are doing chapter two of the this weird mini series we started called the Gastropocene. And before this, I was getting my horoscope figured out. How is that going in the background?
So far we just know Andy's a Scorpio, which is still very telling. As this series progresses, we'll see more of your Scorpio come out.
Yeah, well, maybe. I hope not. I actually don't know what that means.
You don't know what that
So
means. So I'm going to give Andy a full reading and actually explain what astrology is through a not white, like actual, decolonized, complicated lens.
yes, this will be interesting. So today we are not talking about astrology. We are talking about chapter two of the zine that we just put out this past week. And yeah, there's a lot to unpack, and I think folks, we did get some interesting feedback, and I think folks are really interested to have us talk a little bit further about the concepts that we've been kind of uncovering around food systems, veganism, climate change, ecology, colonialism, how all these things overlap, and what a solution looks like.
Yeah, and I think with this one, I actually like that we got a little bit more technical in trying to parse some of the lingo, I guess, climate change jargon, I like to call it. Like when you hear the word like carbon emissions, it's just like this, the stuff that you hear that, or sustainability or ethical, whatever, right? Like ethical, cruelty-free, like all these words that I think when we sit down and actually think about it, and really think about how it works and how stuff is quantified and how, such complex problems and complex processes in nature are being reduced to very simple metrics. It starts to become a little bit more hairy. And I myself start to realize I don't actually know what ethical means, for example, or what sustainability means half the time when I actually dig into it,
Yeah, it's really ambiguous the way these terms are used, and I think that's on purpose because it makes you feel good, and then like trying to quantify, like you said, what is ethical, is really difficult, right? It's more of a feeling than like something you can like put assign like a number to or something like that, right? And like that plays into this idea of like how do we tackle climate change? We're going to make these details very ambiguous. We're going to give this vague impression that things are always progressing, right? You go to, Target or whatever store's website, and they'll talk about like, how they've reduced their footprint, how they're being sustainable, regenerative, all these different things, right? For every kilowatt of energy we use, we plant 50 trees or whatever it might be,
Or like
right?
for every Toms you buy, there's like five children in Africa that are being fed, right? Like it's just these very oversimplified statements that are really designed to solely play on individualism and people's egos, right? To get them to believe that they're making a quote unquote ethical consumption. And yeah, that's exactly, well, what we're talking about is greenwashing, exactly. So, and maybe because that's brought up, we can talk a little bit about what greenwashing is. So, and when we're talking about greenwashing, there's many types of washing of capitalism, but in general, capitalism finds a way to basically reform itself to be more palatable and just about make any sort of injustice profitable, right? And the way it does that is it sees an opportunity and it creates a market. So when there's feminism, it sees an opportunity and starts creating an entire market around, branding products as like these products directed at a consumer base that identifies as femme or women, right? And that's called pinkwashing. There's a whole industry around basically just like pasting the rainbow all over your products and thinking that actually does shit for the queer community when it doesn't, right? And that's called like rainbow washing or purple washing, whatever you want to call it. So greenwashing is just another like variation of that, where words like sustainability and eco-friendly and recyclable and just like cruelty-free are just slapped on when something as simple as like there is not, like those words don't actually mean anything. No one's actually verifying anything. Companies can say whatever the hell they want. And that's marketing. That's literally called publicity and marketing. And they can actually get away with just about anything as long as their consumers are buying into it. And there's even like whole, if you even look up greenwashing, you can see like these six, like, you know, stereotypical sins of greenwashing, which literally are what Andy just mentioned. Like the first one is vagueness, like being very purposefully non-specific and using really fancy jargon that makes people feel better, right? That these words that sound better, but mean actually nothing, and not being able to come up with any concrete, tangible answers. And also the whole like lesser of two evils, right? It's just like, oh, all corporations are bad, but at least we're vegan, right? Which again, that doesn't mean shit, right? But it's just like this idea of, and we know that maybe with like, you know, electoral politics, right? Like when we're talking about like Democrats and Republicans, right? It doesn't mean anything when you're talking about a rotten system. Yeah, there's little, like, I guess, little tricks and things that they use. And I think what we talked about in our series, second part of our series, is one type of trick, basically, which is this oversimplification and making it seem like, you know, we're so good. And you can tell, look at the numbers. The numbers tell like how good we are.
Yeah. And that's exactly what we're starting to see. When we talk about this idea of like climate change, right, this is a global phenomenon that's happening, that we, the best computers on Earth, struggle to model exactly what that looks like. Right. But we've been sold this idea of like our like carbon, right? How much carbon can we emit? Right. If we have to keep it under a certain number, and that is, been disconnected from this concept of climate change, right? As long as we can get carbon, nothing else matters. We can drop, you know, everything kind of goes into place. And there's a reason why they've done that, because carbon is something that you can put back into the soil, right? It's something that we can capture in some capacity through technology, which means you've created a new market. And this is really important and interesting for a number of reasons. The first is, if you're anywhere on the spectrum of anti-capitalist, and even most capitalists will agree with this argument, that like the tendency of profit, or the rate of profit, tends to fall, right? That you have, when new businesses or new industries start up, there's a high growth period. You see this with small cap stocks, if you're interested in the stock market, right? People invest in small cap stocks because there's a higher rate of return. There's more risk, but there's a higher rate of return because there's growth opportunity. And the general idea is, if you diversify in small cap stocks, you're going to have a higher growth rate. And you can kind of hedge that bet by having that diversity. But generally speaking, the idea is small cap stocks do really well. They grow faster because there's more growth rate, right? And then you get to like blue chip stocks, your traditional, the market is saturated with these products type of companies, and your General Electrics and things like that. Mm-hmm. They grow at the rate of inflation plus about 1%, give or take, mm-hmm. right? And that's how we kind of gauge growth, right? And that model.
Well, and I mean, that growth is like proportional to how these new industries are created and how appealing they become at the right time, right? Yeah. And that's where like capitalist co-optation is so important. They take advantage of, like, whole movements have been co-opted, right? Like police brutality happens, and then like it's always been happening, and then there's waves of protests and uprisings, and then suddenly you have all of these companies that just like jump on that, and then their stocks like skyrocket, and their like revenue streams are increasing, and there's always this like turnaround. Right now, the thing that's quote unquote sexy is like just green, like being a greener company and a corporation.
Yeah. And then to play into this idea of carbon, you know, if all of these companies are at this point of, or if we think about like globalism, right? So globalism skyrocketed after World War II. We had cheap fuel, peace, quote unquote, peace across the globe, free trade opened up. Basically, American, European companies had an opportunity to cash in on the rest of the world, yeah. Right? We were able to get resources cheaply. We had new markets to sell to, right? And we hit that wall probably 20 years ago, 30 years ago, where there's really not that much growth anymore. We've gone through that small cap cycle, but our economy demands more, you know, bigger returns, right?
Exponential
literally growth. To no end. So yeah. there's no capacity for the conventional model to continue growing at the rate that it has, which is why we're seeing, if you look at the stock market, Yes, it has grown in the last 5 years, like exponentially, but that's the same reason why things like federal interest rates have had to drop, is because that basically is a buffer for that market to continue growing. We've hit 0% a couple of years ago, or close to 0% a couple of years ago, and a number of things have gone on since then, like inflation and so on. But eventually, the point was that, like, as that's going to go up, the market is going to come down. It hasn't yet, but it is going to. Part of why it hasn't yet also is because of what's called a PE ratio, a price to earnings ratio, which is completely out of whack. And we're getting a little bit off topic, but the point is that the system is at the breaking point where it can't continue to grow anymore, right? So what that means is that there needs to be new markets. And why carbon is so attractive is it's something we can resell, repackage back, right? You can scrub econ or scrub the air, through technology, theoretically, right? We can subsidize that entire market, and we can basically, think about it. We have to rebuild the entire globe under the guise of saving the globe, right? We have to tear down all the houses that are built poorly. We have to tear down all the cities. We have to redo all the
It
roads. We have
literally
to.
creates infinite industries out of
Exactly.
this one simple concept of, hey, we just need to decrease our carbon emissions. And what does it take to get to that? I think is an important question that people need to ask, right? Like, and what's being like proposed as solutions for us to decrease carbon emissions, which is where I think our focus even on like the idea that there's one right way to eat, right, comes in because it falls right into that bucket, right? Because essentially personal virtue is this eternally like seductive technique that corporations use. And just this idea that people can make, personal choices that are superior, right? Personal choices that are inherently more moral and better in the way that they consume things, right? As consumers. So not personal choices in terms of like their political alignments, but like literally what they're consuming, right? Off of shelves. And that's, the narrative that that's enough for you to make, do your part, right? Make a significant impact on the planet is like that. That's their main individualistic sort of like talking point. And that's what they target, right? That individualism and that like sort of socialized ego that we all have from being like raised under capitalism. And people then forget, like, what are these corporations actually selling us, right? So they're telling us if we buy more of their products, that's going to save the planet. Right? If we buy more of their stocks, that's going to save the planet if we support them. Right? And I think I remember just like reading some of these statistics in like some of these like cited really, and Andy, we cited it in our article, but like these well-cited papers that are always cited for like evidence for how meat production from factory farms, for example, is like the biggest source of carbon emissions or whatever, right? Those big papers that are always cited. It's interesting how essentially carbon emissions, when we look at them on a global scale, like these are massive global averages, right? About how much carbon, like what our carbon footprint is. I mean, and number one, even the idea of a carbon footprint. I mean, I don't know, like most people should know this if you know what greenwashing is, but basically British Petroleum, which is like one of the top 10 corporations that is responsible for like 45% of carbon emissions, single-handedly came up with the idea of an individual carbon footprint by hiring like a PR firm, Ogilvy and Mather, basically, to create this whole idea of how people can be convinced that all they have to do is just like calculate their individual household's carbon footprint. And BP is going to spearhead that campaign. So to cover up for all of the massive like crimes against the planet that they're doing. And that's it. And it worked. It's like insidious propaganda, but it worked really well because since then, people have been so hyper-focused on like, what's my individual carbon footprint? What's my household carbon footprint? What's your institutional carbon footprint? Right. But I remember reading these like statistics about the carbon footprint that is the biggest from, one, like meat consumption, and then it being narrowed down to like 25% of producers representing like 65% of all of the beef herds, for example. And when you look at like who those 25% of producers are, they're basically like poor communities living in sub-Saharan Africa that are largely reliant on meat because they are, you have basically poor soils, low rainfall, and year, like just centuries of colonialism that have led you to, again, depend on meat as your primary source of food because you can't get like year-round crop production. And that's where the biggest, you know, so-called consumptions are coming from. And that's how they like use these big averages to blame certain communities. And then while all the while increasing like personal egos, and it just creates this like divide and conquer sort of dynamic.
Yeah. And you know, you brought up the BP thing, and I don't know if you know this, but that's where recycling came from too. So for folks that aren't familiar with the history of recycling, it was actually an effort by corporations because they knew people were getting frustrated with the fact that there was pollution everywhere to basically self-tax themselves to start a recycling program with putting the onus on people to have to recycle versus making biodegradable products or something, you know, some alternative to, you know, the way we consume plastics and our food and all these things today. And that was a giant PR piece where the government didn't even step in. It was these companies saying, we're going to get ahead of this before you mandate that we have to be responsible for our shit. Because before recycling existed, your response would be like, why are you making something that like is sitting in the ground for 500 years? That's ridiculous. Instead, mm-hmm. they're like, no, you just have to bring it to this place where it's not going to get used. And we're going to pretend we're going to do this thing.
There's no accountability. And this is important, right? When it comes to corporations and the state, so capitalism and the state in general, there is no accountability, right? No. You can't make corporations do what you want. You can't actually verify anything. You can't actually look to see if they're doing the thing, eco-friendly thing that they're claiming that they're doing and branding all their products with. That's just how it works, right? And that's how basically people are unaware that like 85% of like all of the fake meat industry is owned by major meat producers, right? Where it's just like, right? Like, and that can happen because people truly do not know where their food actually comes from because they're able to pay for it and buy it like a you know, object, a commodity, a product off the shelf, right? As opposed to being intimately involved in actually understanding what it takes, right? Being connected to communities and into like to the plants, animals, and like microbes responsible for actually creating that food.
Yeah. So to get back to the point of bringing up carbon, like having this isolated thing that can be commodified allows business to continue as usual, as much as it can under climate change, right? So now there's this thing, there's a target we can address. There's an insular thing that doesn't, it's like we fix this, we don't have to address all the other fundamental issues of our climate.
Right? Just capitalism, colonial, just everything else, right?
And even the ecology piece, which is why we name this climate change or ecology, because climate change is a component of ecological degradation. It is not this individualistic thing that exists because, you know, we stuck too many straws in the earth and pulled out all the oil. Like, that's a piece of it, but that ecological or the climate wouldn't be changing the way it is if it weren't for the ecological component, the, you know, the total devastation that's happened across the globe, right?
So total devastation has happened because like literally destruction of land and like separating people from their land, that process is like all of that ecological destruction is the fabric of colonialism, right? Like it operates on considering the planet just a product that can be extracted and exploited endlessly for profit and nothing more, right? Nothing else is of value.
Yeah. And a part of that as well is taking people and disconnecting them from the land. Mm-hmm. It's not just enough to take the land and exploit it. It's mm-hmm. necessary for that process to actually be able to happen. You have to disconnect people so they have no relation to that land, right? Mm-hmm. When we talk about, you know, caring about our local ecosystems, it almost always falls back on NIMBYism, right? Not in my backyard. Yeah. It's not about not doing it. It's just not doing it where I live. Mm-hmm. And that is a fundamental disconnect because you're not thinking about the landscape. You're thinking about your window or whatever it might be, right?
Something as simple as like, you know, just like nation states and borders that cut across ecological boundaries that make no sense, right? And the level of like death and destruction that's led to. And that's a direct result of just like post-colonialism recreation of boundaries, right? So the other thing I was thinking of is corn. We talked about corn and soy as these, which I think is like a simple but like really cool illustration of just how historically these crops have come out to be, like, gone from being what they were, like, in especially with corn, with like the diversity and the way that corn was, like the relationship that corn had to communities that were, you know, essentially creating all of these diverse types of corn, to now where it is now, where it's just like this like monocrop that's just taken over the world. And that is because of this idea of like what it is as a C4 plant.
Yeah. And corn is, you know, like you said, it has this really unique history. It's a very special plant because it's one of the few crops that we grow for food that is a C4 grass, which grows exceptionally fast, does well in high temperature environments. It uses most of its energy for like seed production, which is what corn is. And, you know, it has thinner leaves, like all the energy is going towards growing the food basically that we need. And that's like ideal, right? Unfortunately, when we think about, you know, again, the way capitalism, you know, isolates things and thinks about a maximum productivity, that has led to what we have today. And there are benefits to that for, like, you know, we can't understate the fact that corn produces an incredible amount of, you know, calories per acre compared to anything else. But it is steeped in a very complicated history that's worth unpacking. Not right now. I spent an hour and I barely scratched the surface on Poor Pearl's Almanac. So you can listen over there.
Oh, if you really that's the plug. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you want to listen to an hour of me rambling about corn, that is one place to do it. However, the point is that corn has gotten this really bad rap around food, particularly around like feeding livestock. We talked about that a little bit in chapter one. For folks that didn't listen to that, I'll give you a really quick summary. And then I do want to talk about soy a little bit. But with corn, the thing that's really important to understand is that corn became the byproduct of basically World War II, at least corn as we see it today, for a number of reasons. Between the Dust Bowl and World War II, the U.S. government made sure that we would never have food shortages again. That was basically why we spend as much money as
possible. That's what they were, trying.
Yeah, so the goal was that there will always be enough food. And then it was like, how do we utilize this product that we've created, you know, high fructose corn syrup, you know, various isolates, you know, ethanol.
Yeah, it can turn into like literally everything from like a filler to just like sugars and like a diesel and just everything began to be derived from corn that could be shoved into as many industries as possible. And again, with the idea of this like exponential growth model.
Yeah. And then we could ship those products out. But the important thing to understand, though, with corn is that in this process, many of these products can be made out of the same kernel of corn. However, at the end of it, there's certain parts of the corn that are not edible for humans. And there's only a limited amount of ways to utilize that byproduct. A lot of that is going to livestock feed. So when you usually see those numbers of 70% of corn is grown for livestock feed, it's because by weight, 70% of the plant is going to the livestock as feed, not because 7 out of 10 plants that's put in the ground is for livestock. And that's a very important difference, because even if we got rid of those cattle, that byproduct would still exist and probably just go to compost. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but that's not going to feed people.
And neither is it going to stop corn from being commodified and being like created into all of these byproducts that are then created into other products and packaged as like fuel or oil or starch or sugars, right? Like none of that is going to stop, and none of those industries are going to
fundamentally nothing changes, right? Like other than you don't eat meat, like nothing else is, like that corn is still going to get grown whether or not it's fed to cattle. Now the same thing happened with soy in a slightly different story, where during World War One and Two, where soy oil was really important for a number of different industries, as the U.S. lost its relations with most of Asia, they relied on growing their own soy all of a sudden. And they got very good at growing it, realized that it had a lot of benefits. And then during World War Two, or after World War Two, rather, they had this huge industry that they weren't going to just hand back over. And especially because a lot of the world was decimated, we became a major exporter of food. We were like one of the only places that didn't get bombed during World War II.
That's often how that works even today, right? This opportunistic, like seeing industries and then finding a way to take food, like make food a commodity, like literally to basic essential survival resources and taking opportunity of like death, destruction, starvation, war, and then America just like swooping in. And that's literally what like soy was.
Yeah. Yeah. And so soy became this huge industry because we could export it. Much like corn, there's a whole bunch of different uses for it. It actually originally, because people didn't eat a lot of soy in this country, they would take the oil and then that was the only thing of value, and then let cattle graze the fields and just kind of clean up what was left. But they continued after they started finding more uses for it, soy protein isolate and things like that. And then the byproduct, that meal, just like corn, this not digestible by humans piece of it, was fed to cattle because it had nowhere else to go.
Yeah. Now, and basically now there's so many more, like if you think of like soy before versus now, the only difference is there's many more industries making sure that they can exploit as much of like a single gram of soy as possible.
Yeah. And like, being done with it. Yeah. And like with soy, you know, one of the, much like corn, you know, there's a lot of debate about like whether or not, well, I don't even want to say a lot of debate. There are arguments made that soy wouldn't be as profitable or corn wouldn't be as profitable if we got rid of the livestock. And while that might be slightly true, the reality is that the researchers today are not trying to grow these plants to produce more of that meal that's fed to cattle. They're focusing on producing more of the oil because that is the high value part of the crop. And that's important because what that means is that even if that livestock isn't around, they're going to continue to grow that product for that reason. And what's unique about soy and corn in particular and those oils is those are the primary oils that we use for preserved and processed foods.
So, and not even that, oh, if we just take away the like, you know, factory farm meat industry, that, you know, soy and corn are going to continue to be exploited and continue to go towards something else. But truly that this model of exponential growth and exploitation and extraction is going to exponentially continue, right? Because again, it's not the meat, it really is the capitalism that's the problem. And in that model, especially with like biofuels, for example, that's a huge burgeoning industry right now that's like absolutely taking off under this guise of like, we're trying to save the planet, right? Yeah. So everything from like soy and corn are trying to be repurposed as these like fuels that can then be exploited as well, right? To keep these corporations going, but just like slightly defecting and relying on different things. Yeah. And now we have everything from that to like this new age wellness industry that a lot of where soy is going is into that, right? Like soy protein and soy isolate and soy going into supplements. And so it just creates like what capitalism does is create new markets and new consumers and then like harps on their individualistic identities and finds a way to get them really deeply invested in maintaining that product, right? Because they see a core part of their personal identity attached to that product and consuming that product. So with or without meat, that exponential growth is going to continue. Those profit streams are going to continue. And therefore, all of the loss of biodiversity that comes with, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in chapter three, like what it actually takes to make these like crops, these large scale industrial farms, and what the cost is to the environment, right? Like loss of biodiversity, habitat destruction, all of the animals and people that die as a result of these like large scale farms, right? That is going to exponentially continue. And yeah, that's, I think, what, like, it's not just that like it'll help at all. It won't help at all because capitalism finds a way to reinvent itself and make sure that it keeps going like by any means necessary.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the point here, I think, is really that when we talk about food systems and we talk about corn and soy and beef and all these things, that it's not as simple as just saying, let's cut one of these pieces out, right? These are all integrated with a very complicated history of why we're where we are right now. And we have to understand that those relationships are fluid. And what that means is that if one of those pieces moves or shifts, the other pieces are going to find a way to work, just like they found a way when World War II ended and they had these, you know, huge industries that existed and suddenly didn't need to exist anymore. They found a way to make it work. It was meat. And that's, you know, taking that meat piece out of it is like taking a kid's toy away from him when he's got a room full of toys. Like, he's going to find something else eventually.
And I mean, we see that with like a lot of these horrible like food corporations, right? These, and not just like the agro corporations, but also just like food corporations, like fast food chains that now have just like vegan options, right? Alongside meat options, because it's just a profitable industry and a profitable consumer base to exploit, right? And it doesn't change any practices. It doesn't actually change anything, but people will think that that's a sign of change. And I think that's what's important, right? Because, and people may be thinking like, why are we talking so much about this stuff? Because if we're actually going to talk about what we can do to be a part of like preventing ecological destruction in any capacity and really thinking about what comes after, we need to start thinking about how much of our energy may be misdirected at things that actually don't work, right? Yeah. And that's what capitalism does really well, because we have to start thinking critically about why, like century after century, like colonialism just reformed itself into just being capitalism, right? It's the same thing, same global power dynamics. It just is more palatable. And how did that shift actually happen to where we didn't see this coming, right? Like, but we did. And how do we learn from that history? By knowing how like these systems basically refine themselves and become more palatable and adapt and continue and in a way strengthen themselves over time by doing this, right? Capitalism's strength is its ability to take advantage about just about anything. It doesn't care about the social cause. It doesn't care about any kind of like movement or any community, right? But it will find a way to use you. It will find a way to take advantage of you, and it will find a way to make money off of you. And that's all it cares about. And as long as it can do that, it will stay here, right? And as long as we keep buying into that, then we will keep being like uncritical consumers.
Yeah. And I think it comes down to this idea of isolating and distance, right? Isolating a product is, it's easy. Like, they don't care if we go after, you know, meat or whatever. They'll find a way around it. And honestly, and we discussed this last episode, that like Tyson and all these big companies, they don't care. And they are happy to go back or go to not producing meat, because there's a whole bunch of risks that go with raising meat and slaughtering it and all of the things that go with it that are, it makes it much less profitable. It makes it much more risky. And if they can sell you Soylent Green, then they're on board to sell you that and keep, you know, free range meat
at the expense of the like land, at the expense of the people that are doing like that are going to be responsible for actually the labor that goes into all of this, right? That's going to continue, and that's going to exponentially increase, because that's just what capitalism does. And I think maybe people can think about this in the context of what we understand now to be like identity politics, right? Where we talk about like, you can't just say, just think about an identity or an issue like a oppression of a single community in isolation as though it's totally independent from everything else that goes on, right? Like when we talk about how our like struggles are connected and tied and therefore our liberations are tied, that's exactly what this is. Like we can't separate just making individual better seeming like diet choices, right? Which inherently comes at the expense of like that, in order to even say that, right? There's a lot of privilege with thinking that you as a consumer can just, you know, use your dollars to be able to make that change, right? But also inherently comes with the judgment and the superiority complex that's leveraged over categorizing communities, right? That for generations have been able to exist outside the framework of capitalism and colonialism through ethical food practices in connection with their land that include omnivorous communities, right? And it comes at the expense of those communities being categorized as, again, like savage and backward and uncivilized, or at best in need of like conversion, right? They're just uneducated. They just need to be, you know, if they just had access to vegan products, they would convert, right? It's like, tell me, you know what this sounds like, right? And that's why we're doing this, because we can't do this shit again and again and again, right? Yeah. Where we're doing a type of colonialism and we're still like, it's not even okay to call it out, right? For what it is. And I think that's why it's so important for us to actually direct our attention and energy towards like solidarity building and understanding that there is value to us thinking about systems, not reducing problems to individuals or like a select issue, right? Whether it's carbon or like, let's just stop consuming meat. And also value to us trying really hard to understand how other communities that are different than us like do things, right? And try to understand it from a place of like humility.
Yeah. And this brings us back to the question of climate change, right? Where, how do we address the issues of climate change, or is the real issue climate change, or is climate change that singular focus, right? Much like carbon, where climate change is a component of ecology. And that's, I think, where we need to start thinking is, okay, if we understand climate change as this, like, you know, to use a metaphor, like the earth is running a fever because it's, having these health issues, right? That's like a very fundamental way of thinking about it. Like, the climate change is a symptom of what's happening to our ecology. Climate change is not this separate thing that exists because of, again, sticking straws in the ground and sucking out the oil and burning it. It's actually because of a very complicated problem that's happening to the planet. And then if we're going to solve that, if we're going to tackle that issue, that doesn't mean electric cars and continuing to like live the way we live today, right? It
And that
means things.
involves addressing that complexity. Like it
Yeah.
involves addressing that complexity, even though it's uncomfortable, even though it's harder. And I think that's where like people get stuck, right? It's so much easier to just say that I'm gonna make a better personal choice and like coddle myself and go to sleep better, right? It's so much, of course, it's easier to do that, but it's like much harder to look into the mirror and truly ask, do you actually know what, like where your food is coming from? Like who it's actually hurting, right? Is it actually helping animals? Because like, what about the fucking like ground mammals that are killed when you have monocrop plantations, right? Like, it's just like, is it actually doing the thing that you're telling yourself? So is it more about being perceived as being someone who cares about the planet, or do you actually want to care about the planet?
Yeah, and this I think all boils down to why we decided to focus on the what we called this series the Gastropocene, because our ecosystem destruction is predicated on the way we eat our food, right? And what I think we're going to get to with our final few chapters of this will be the solutions are also based in that same framework, that the solutions to climate change and ecological collapse are based in the way we relate to our food and where our food comes from. And that can be really intimidating for a number of reasons, because anyone that's spent any time thinking about foraging or gone foraging like once or grown like a carrot knows how much work goes into that process.
Yeah, and
And
just
like,
that much. And it's like, then imagine like judging communities that have literally been responsible for feeding themselves, right? And we'll talk a lot about that in just like chapter three, where the word separation, like we talked about it in terms of like how carbon, like talking about carbon emissions is just distancing us from like the complexity of the problem, right? Like how complex it really is. And that's the same, that's really a byproduct of us having been used to being distanced from things, right? It's a byproduct of us being consumers that actually have no intimate connection to or direct accountability for like being involved in the process of how our food is cultivated, right? Therefore, being directly responsible for the toll that that takes on every single like human being to plant to animal involved in that process and that web of relationships, right? And so we're used to that separation, right? Which is what gets people to think that they can just overnight make better personal diet choices, right? Like they can just change their lifestyle overnight. When this take capitalism out of that picture, like that sounds ridiculous to a community when what they eat is directly dictated by not just their local ecological context and their environment, but their like 1,000-year-old traditions, tried and true practices that they've had to see what works and what doesn't work, adapting constantly to their environment, seeing what works for other plants and animals, and like cultivating their soil. Like it's just so complex. They do not just wake up in the morning and say, I'm gonna go to the grocery store and just, you know, not buy meat today, right? And that just shows like the inherent, it is an embodiment of that separation, right? Total distancing from nature where we don't really understand that we're totally a part of it, which means that we have to be willing to get down and dirty and really messy. And I guess that's where we thought about the idea of like meeting your meat, right? Like really understanding where your food comes from, because that's like what you should be willing to do if you are really invested in thinking about like ethical food, right? Like what that actually means. And it's never going to be as pretty as like, you know, you'd like it, you know, to where it's just like, oh, vegan food, great. Yeah, like you've done your job, right?
And there's a really great Simpsons episode of, I think it's when Lisa's a vegetarian and they go to a steakhouse, but it's a you can pick your own steak, and they like walk around and they pick the cow that they want,
Oh my God.
and they like use the like stun gun to like kill the cow. They're like, I want that one. Homer's like, actually, I think I want that one. So he ends up like killing like three cows because he's like can't pick which one he wants.
And I mean,
But like
that
it's
actually speaks to something important
yeah.
though, right? Like, but I want people to think about that same thing. Like, you know, you might love your tofu, but I want you to go on that monocrop plantation in Southeast Asia where your soy is coming from and see what is happening to those communities, see what is happening to like the pollinators and the insects and the ground mammals there, and then really tell me to my face that like, oh no, this is ethical, right? Like, and that's what we're saying. Like, we need to really understand the granularity, like, to that extent. And yeah, that gives us better solution, like actual solutions that work, if we're not just pretending, right?
Yeah, and you brought up, before I rambled about The Simpsons, a really interesting point that I think is important to just make a point of your point. And that is when you were talking about this idea that, like, communities that are in relations with their food systems are constantly evaluating and adjusting their systems, that it's not this... I think we have this idea of, and this is probably based in the way we're taught history in school, that, like, these communities, because they haven't advanced with us in terms of, like, these evolutionary moments, that
they're backwards. Yeah. Uncivilized.
Yeah. Well, that they're, like, static, right? That they haven't changed in, you know, X thousand amount of years, that if they're doing things this way, it's because they've always done it this way, not because that is a refined process in relation, you know, a dialogue with the ecological community around them. And that's the reality. And that's something that, you know, I think people forget, that if we're talking about food systems, and we'll talk about this more, like I said, in the future, but how that dialogue looks and how, you know, going towards a bioregionally focused food system doesn't mean that we're going to turn the clocks backwards, you know, 2000 years or something.
No, yeah. But it also doesn't mean that we're not going to understand the value of, essentially, you know, capitalism is like 200 years old, like, and colonialism in the traditional sense is like 400, 500, 600 years old. And then we're talking about communities that have been able to create sustainability, right? Like, have been able to exist in their, like, ecological niche by, like, maintaining the integrity of the soil that they're on, making sure that they're actually creating what is needed to sustain their communities, and keeping this, like, intricate ecological balance and harmony between all of the, like, millions of different types of, like, you know, everything from, like, insects, plants, animals, to, like, that are living with them, right? And that requires this constant adaptation, and also the environment and all the stressors that it throws at you, to being able to adapt to that, right? Which means that a lot of these methods, like traditional systems, food systems, have come from what we now call science, right? Like, but it's been, like, mocked when we think about it in the traditional sense, where there's this idea, and I think that is colonialism, right? This judgment, and we'll go into that more in the third chapter, that there's this judgment passed on other communities, especially historically, and historical traditional systems of food systems, just based on the fact that they're historical, or just based on the fact that they're not backed by Western science and objectivity metrics, when they are. Just that there's colonialism came around and asserted this one dominant, hegemonic, one-size-fits-all global system and enforced it, that led to, like, the violent erasure of so many of these traditional systems, right? That still resiliently exist today in many ways, that are, like, probably the reason that we're still here to some extent, right? Like, a lot of these food systems are still here. So they're not that they were just done in the past. A lot of communities are still doing them, have found ways to do them, continue to adapt resiliently to the ecological, like, issues that we're facing, right? And are on the front lines of these ecological issues.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I find it, you know, really hopeful to know that people are figuring it out. And, you know, I think in some ways there's, I guess you could say, like, a lot of potential, I think, in particularly, I think, rural communities here in the U.S. that I think, especially, you know, I know a lot of hunters that are not politically aligned with me, and a lot of them are very aware of the fact that things are not what they used to be even 20 years ago. And they'll never utter the words climate change, but they will say it's not the same. And I think that's,
and they don't need to, right? Because just because the judgment that's passed on rural communities too, with, like, the elitism and the, like, just the idea that they don't know anything, and the liberal sort of judgment of, like, literacy, right? That's the same stuff even, like, when it comes to rural farmers in the South in America, or just, like, rural farmers in, like, Southeast Asia or South Asia, right? Like, it's just this idea that they've been finding ways to sustain their communities and feed their communities. And to me, that is hopeful, because it doesn't mean that I have to, one, reinvent the wheel, and two, it really is coming down to like thinking very critically about, do you want to tell yourself you're doing what like, you know, the best thing that you could possibly do, and you've done everything that you can to save this planet, right? Or do you actually like want to build these solutions with other people? Because to me, the latter seems so much more hopeful and relieving and liberating, right? That I'm not alone, that I don't, not just we are figuring this out. Thousands of generations of knowledge has existed on how we can do this, right? And we have to be able to like look to so many of these resources that we already have and see what we can do. And that's like, that's relieving to me. Like, I feel like, ooh, thank God. So I don't know why I would want to tell myself that I have all these solutions, right? Or everybody that thinks like me, exactly like me, has all these solutions, because that's a lonely place. And honestly, like, it just feels terrifying, because at the end of the day, we're not going to save this planet with more colonialism, which is exactly what it is when you're telling other communities to just change their entire food ways, their entire like traditions and cultural systems, because you think that they are, you know, based on your very subjective, reductive definition of what is ethical, right?
Yeah. And, you know, to go back to this whole conversation on meat, I did see an interesting stat recently. I think it was like 2 days ago, that was like actually per capita, the meat consumption is actually down over the last 50 years in the United States.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Why? Because of the rise of a lot of. Yeah.
Yeah. So, which is interesting, because we always hear about like, we're, you know, we're clearing forests for, you know, cattle and blah, blah, blah.
And that's true all around. Like, so the global like rates of meat consumption have like, you know, pretty significantly decreased over the last, especially 20 years. But what's interesting is ecological destruction has increased. Species extinction has accelerated. Our carbon emissions, even by those metrics, have increased. So like, you know, like there has to be something, right? Like, it's not the thing that's going to save us, because things are still getting worse.
Yeah. And I think statistically, like even if you're to look at like raw energy production, food production is not a very large piece of the, again, think from the carbon perspective of energy production and energy use. So like,
guess what is?
Yeah. There's a handful of things that you can blame, starting with the military. But you know, when we talk about food, I think what's so important about it is that it is very much who we are. When we think about who we are, our identities, right? And we talk about what it means to be whatever it is. A lot of that falls down to our cultural piece. And what is our culture? Our culture is a reflection of the community and its place and its time, right? Yeah. And that means
because it is one thing. It's that integrated model of like, you're, especially when you're not doing it as a consumer, right? The thing that you eat has been a part of you in a very intimate sense. Like you love for, like you love, it's come out of love, care, and just generations of like collectivism that have been poured into like bringing even a single dish, right? When we think about like one dish and the evolution of a dish over time, right? For like Black and Brown communities and how it gets passed down through generations and how it evolves and different ingredients that it incorporates all make sense to the local ecological context, right? And the processes of even creating that food. And now you're talking about just like, just stop doing all of that, right? And thinking that that's gonna be the thing that saves us. Right. When you're talking about communities destroying themselves. Right. And that is erasure. That is like when you're asking for a community to change the way that they eat just because it's been deemed as solely capitalist. Right. Like there's no way to, even though they've always existed without it outside of the framework of it, then that basically means erasure of that community itself, because that's what we're talking about when we talk about integration. Like you can't separate climate change from ecology. You cannot separate what a community like eats from who they are. You just can't, right? In the same way, like you can't separate basically the damage and destruction that comes from fossil fuels or the military, like we just talked about, and nation states and war, from all of the other stuff related to the food that we eat, right? Because we're all talking about the same system here.
Yeah. Now, did I talk about a New Jersey Italian's last gastropocene? Do you remember?
No.
Does that sound familiar?
No.
Oh, this is my favorite story or example of what you're talking about with New Jersey Italians. So as a non-New Jersey Italian whose parents came off the boat, you know, I always used to get so frustrated with New Jersey Italians because of like their like weird culture that is not Italian, but they are very vocal about it being Italian. and
Wait,
they're
what do you
connected.
mean? What about it? What
Like
exactly?
Sopranos, kind of like,
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
like New Jersey, New York, Italian, right? Like it's has no ref and like they even make fun of it in the sh in one of the episodes when they go to Italy, and like they're totally disconnected from like what Italian culture and identity is. And there's a number of reasons for that, right? Because just like we were talking, culture isn't static. It doesn't just stop because you moved away, right? And then what happens to cultures is they either evolve or they die. And for like New Jersey Italians, like it's evolving. And like, as much as that might disgust me because it's not like what they pretend it is, like there's some like really unique and peculiar, you could say, like cultural like artifacts that have come from that. That is like, this is a New York, New Jersey, tri-state like Italian identity. It is not like anything else on earth. And like, when we talk about this idea of like we've been distanced from the land and we need to reconnect with it, what does that look like? What does it look like in terms of culture, right? What does it look like in terms of creating new food ways?
And what does it look, and I think the example, perfect example of creating new food ways, and what does it look like even in terms of like cultural I guess reestablishing is like migrants, right? Like diasporic cultures and how they've evolved in this like very interesting, sad, and also like beautiful way. When I look at like Indians in the diaspora or like Palestinians in the diaspora, as opposed to like people like on the ground in the homeland, right? Like just the issues and the battles that we face are different, and what that's meant for culture and what that's meant for food, but also that's very similar to ecologically how a lot of adaptation over time outside of the framework of capitalism for communities has been natural migration, right? In search of ways to like find easier sources of food, right? Especially for like nomadic tribes that are in areas or regions of the world where like climate issues are that dire that they do have to get up and move. And that's actually been very like normal, and that sort of migration has been just how these communities have integrated themselves into their like ecological niche as they've migrated, which means that it can absolutely be done, like even if we're starting off with a very different context today and dealing with a different set of challenges, that this is something that we can do just communally, right? Like, but we can't do it alone, and we can't do it when we rely on corporations to eat better, right? Like, that's not going to be the thing.
It comes down to relationships, right? And that's, I think, a really important piece to like that New Jersey Italian culture is that like they have communities that are a large proportion of people with similar values, you know, the similar history. And that's not a, you know, a criticism of like multiculturalism, but rather a point about like the value of community itself, right? We live in a world where we're so atomized because of things like technology, right? So we don't have those relationships with our neighbors, our community. And that's something that is fundamental in trying to build culture, build identity. It's not
And
about
we're
that we
trying to
have the
like
same
expand that,
things.
right? Like it saves our life. So like now we're thinking about, I think people are hopefully thinking, especially through the pandemic, about the need for just like knowing people in your community, right? Being there for them, showing up for them, and having those real life relationships. But now we're just talking about knowing like exactly how, where your food comes from, right? Having relationships with the ground that you're on, having relationships with the plants that are in your like ecological niche, with the animals that are in your, so those, it's just an extension of the same thing, right? Like community is what saves us, and ultimately capital, and like all of our issues in our like society today, everything from like our health crises to ecological destruction is just a result of that separation from land and each other and everything within our ecosystems, right? We're just isolated to, and it's created this hyper individualism, and we can't create solutions that are also hyper individualistic.
I think that's a perfect place to stop. Did we cover everything? I think we did.
I think we did. And actually, just so everyone knows, we were going to write part chapter two and three as one, and we did not. We split them into chapter two and three. And hopefully, when people see chapter three, they'll be relieved, because or else it'll be like a 30-minute read, which is vastly unnecessary. So I'm glad we actually did this, because I think focusing on carbon emissions was like a really good, it's like it is only one focus. There's many things that we can focus on similarly. But I think it illustrated a concept we're hoping people can then translate to just about anything to try to understand how, you know, green capitalism works.
And why not even just green capitalism, but like the atomization of problems is just insufficient to solving them, especially at the spectacular scale of climate change, right, and ecological destruction. So yeah, we've had a couple comments. It's been pretty quiet tonight, despite all the people that are here. So if anyone has anything they'd like to drop in there, feel free. Hopefully you guys have been following both of us on the social medias. We are obviously on Facebook if you're watching us over there. It looks like there's
And
about 9 people watching on Facebook and a bunch of people on YouTube and Twitch and Twitter for some reason. I don't know why people watch videos on Twitter. Not judging you, of course, but you know, it's a
also the maybe we can foreshadow a little bit. The third part may be a little bit more intense. So just prepare yourselves for being open-minded and share that with your loved ones because it's even more important. But I think this was a good like buffer for us to dive into basically really talking about monocultures and how there is no one size fits all solution for anything, let alone something as big as like climate change or ecological destruction, but for literally anything.
Yeah, so if you are watching this and if you jumped in later, I saw there was a bunch of people that jumped in around 20 minutes or so. This will be up on the Gastropocene podcast, which is literally just this without the video. I don't do any editing, so you get to listen to us giggle and all that good stuff. So that'll be up probably at some point tomorrow. Otherwise, it should be up on YouTube if you want to watch it over there. I think Twitch keeps it up for a day before you have to like subscribe, which I think you can do. Actually, I think because we don't use it that much anymore, you don't have to subscribe anymore. And that's pretty much it. We'll be back in what, a week? Is that the way we're going
Yeah,
back? 14th?
we're doing another live stream for the third chapter next Monday on the 14th at the same time, so 9 p.m. Eastern.
Yeah, so please join us there. If you don't follow us on social media, we're both on Instagram at Poor Pearl's Almanac and Woke Scientist. And go subscribe to Aisha's Substack so you can go get all of her writing. It's all
Can
good
I also
stuff.
say it's really funny that our podcast, the per like our podcast is like the Gastropocene, who it's posted by technically is the Poor Scientist because
Yes.
we merged the Woke Scientist and Poor Pearl's Almanac, and that actually just like describes me, and I love that.
Yes, it's a beautiful thing. So yeah, thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you all next week.